Thank you. Welcome to the first Sunday after Easter, and we're starting a new series on James, and I think it dovetails rather nicely with the series that we had before during our Lenten reflections on the Upper Room Discourse that Jesus shared with his disciples to this very concrete and practical book in James. You had to categorize the book of James, it would fall into a category that you would call wisdom literature, like Proverbs of the Old Testament. And it gives, there's a lot of things in here that gives guidance for everyday living, and it's very practical. And James provides a description of what it looks like to embody the gospel in our lives. And we'll unpack all that throughout the series. As a way of background, the setting of this letter is that Christianity is spreading, and people all over are coming to Christ. People are hearing Christ's gospel of grace, that salvation is nothing that you can do to earn or unearn in one sense, but something that Christ has done for you and now offers this gift to you freely. And the result is that these communities of faith, these churches, these nascent churches all across Middle East, parts of Europe, Asia Minor, are popping up. And they're forming everywhere. But with this growth, there is confusion. It seems that some of those coming to Christ were doing this thing of separating what they believe in their heads, what they confess as true, with their actions, their lives, what they do with their lives. That faith are confused about, they're thinking that faith is something that they merely assent to. But what we do, they think, is optional. Now, does that sound a little bit familiar? Because that is the same struggle that many of us have. We'll get to more of this in future sermons. To this situation, James, who is, James is an incredibly common name in Old Testament times. It's 40 times there are, the name James is brought up in the New Testament, and there are at least four different Jameses that that are prominent among the inner circle or among the Christians. But this is James, the brother of Jesus himself, or some might say the half-brother, or some might say the step-brother, or however you want to describe it. And this James, he is now one of the leaders of the new church, and he writes this letter describing a faith that does not separate how we live from what we believe. That faith that says both of those things are absolutely necessary in order for anyone to describe what they have as faith. And straight away, so he gets right into this. There's barely a word of greeting in James, right? What does James say for his greeting? Anybody have the Bible open? He has one word of greeting, which is greetings. That's it. And then he gets right into it. He gets right into telling us something critical that we need to face, that we will face as a community, and how we can face it. That's what this section is about. It says, consider it pure joy when you face trials of many kinds. And this gives us this powerful setting. Many of you have heard this passage before, but here we go with this incredibly powerful statement at the very head of James's letter saying, consider it pure joy when you face trials of many kinds. So this is what James wants for us to know. That first is that we will face trials. The first thing that James wants for us to know immediately is that we will face trials. It sounds surprising, but first thing he wants for us to know that we'll face trials of many kinds, not just of some kinds, not just of one kind. He says of many, many different kinds. And by its very placement at the beginning, James is saying how we deal with trials and suffering, how we deal with troubles in our lives, is going to be critical to how we become Christ-like in our faith. James is saying there is a connection between faith, growing in faith, and suffering and trials, and how we deal with suffering and trials that we need to understand. And that's what he's saying. This is lesson number one in Christian community, how to live as a Christian community. Consider it pure joy when you face trials of many kinds. The word trials, and later on he says testing later on, that is used here, has this connotation of smelting. Of melting metal to get it to become pure, right? You guys know smelting, right? You guys have seen pictures of this where they melt metal and the metal separate when it's heated up and it becomes liquid. Ancient coins. So if you think forgery was a kind of issue, ancient coins, you would get the gold coins and the silver coins and bronze coins or whatever else, and each metal, the actual weight of it would have a value. So some people would try to cheat by carving around the outside of the coins to get the weight to be a little bit less, and then filling up these carvings with cheaper metal, something like lead or whatever else that was easy. And the way in which you would find out whether a coin was genuine was you would weigh it, but then you would also melt it. You would also melt some of these. This was done because this, otherwise you could not rely on the currency. And so there's this whole idea, and this is the same word that they would use to test whether or not something is genuine. For metals and coins, but now James uses it to describe our faith. Because the testing of your faith will somehow bring out the purity and growth. Suffering can become a sort of a furnace to test your faith. Suffering tests your faith, right? I met people who would say, and maybe some of you guys will maybe have said it, or maybe have heard people say something like this. Yeah, I used to believe in God. I used to go to church, but then this thing happened, right? Something happened. Something horrible happened, and I just could not believe after that. Does that sound familiar to anyone? Right? People say that all the time. And still others will say something like, well, I thought I knew what it meant to believe. I went to church my entire life, but that day when that happened, when that hardship hit me, like a ton of bricks, I realized my faith really wasn't faith, and I needed to get a new one. I needed to get the real thing, right? Any of that sound familiar? That's exactly what James is saying, because suffering is like a furnace that will test whether your faith in God was real or not. There's something about suffering and the growth of faith that goes hand in hand. Notice also, and we make this point pretty much every time that we get into the topic of suffering, but the Bible is very consistent about this. It says, James does not say, if you face trials, if you face troubles. James rather says, consider it. It will happen when it happens. You will face trials. We heard Jesus himself say this in the Upper Room Discourse, right? In John 15, when we're going through it, it says, no servant is greater than the master. And if they come after me, if they persecute me, if I have troubles, then what makes you think that you will not have troubles? Right? If I have troubles, if they persecute me, surely they will persecute you. Surely you will face troubles on your own, of your own as well. This is interesting because most other religions of that time, and even nowadays, are always about doing things for the gods so that you can what? Do you can avoid suffering. That is at the core of many religions. That is at the core of pretty much every other religion of Jesus' time. You do something for God, and you have entire Greek tragedies built around this sort of drama. Somebody wants to avoid suffering, right? So that they do this for their gods. They do this sort of sacrifice, or they make this sort of promise, and then they are able to avoid that suffering. The Greek tragedies come because oftentimes there's a twist, right? There's a not no. When you said you would give up anything, were you willing to give up this, right? We want to avoid suffering, though. So we will do whatever the gods ask us to do. And that is the premise of most of the religions of that time, but not Christianity. Jesus suffered to bring redemption for the world. Redemption didn't come in spite of suffering, but rather through it. Redemption comes through suffering, right? Jesus doesn't avoid suffering, right? Jesus doesn't disappear on the night of the cross to avoid the real pain. Jesus doesn't kind of take himself out of it. Jesus doesn't give himself some sort of a divine drug to not feel the pain, but rather he feels everything and then some and then even more. He feels the suffering, and our redemption is found through the suffering. If you're a Christian, James is telling us, then you should expect suffering. You shouldn't be surprised by it. It is going to happen. This is hard for us to believe. This is hard for us even now to believe. As much as this is what the Bible is consistently teaching us about suffering and faith, this is hard for us to believe. Right? I think many of you guys heard the very tragic news yesterday of Pastor Rick Warren's son committing suicide. And I'm not a friend of Rick Warren's, or I'm not close buddies with him or whatever. There's a right sort of respect, but Esther and I, we were both very incredibly bothered by it. There was something that struck us very deep in our hearts. And I think part of it was, and I think it's true for everybody else as well, but part of it was, it's just this sense of like, no matter what you might say about Rick Warren, this is a good man. This is a good family. He loves God clearly. And clearly, this just seems just so shocking, more shocking. If this was in a family that was messed up and doing awful things, there would be grief. There would be sadness. But I don't know if there would be as much shock. Because we still feel, in one sense, that we ought to be, as Christians, we ought to be protected. We ought to be spared pains of this world. We ought to somehow escape it. And we know this is not true in Christian theology, but we still kind of hold on to it. Part of it, I think, is because our culture, our society, everything else around us, we're in denial of suffering, especially in America. I would say especially in Southern California, particularly so in Orange County, particularly so if you happen to live in Irvine. Because I realize if I die in Irvine, there is no funeral home in Irvine. Right? Nobody dies in Irvine. Right? As far as I can tell, because no funeral homes exist in Irvine. Where would we go to get our caskets? You know, Costco sells it online, but only if you really search for it. You know, where were we in Irvine? This is a place that lives in denial of the possibility that people can die in one sense. If you go to the seminary is a kind of, like a slip, right? So, cemeteries around Irvine in Orange County, they're pristine. They're gorgeous. They're incredibly peaceful. If you ever have a chance to go to cemeteries in Europe or East Coast, even some of the older towns in the East Coast, or different parts of the world, cemeteries are scary places. Right? And there's some gloominess about it, and some of it is, you know, it's just, you just would not want to walk through it at night. But the cemeteries in Orange County, especially Southern California, these are places that you could picnic in if you didn't realize you were in a cemetery, right? We live in a place that's in denial of suffering. We do everything possible to not, to think that we cannot possibly suffer. If you talk to doctors, they will tell you that people, I wind up talking to a lot of doctors because I take my parents, they're always like, they take turns about being sick about something else. We wind up talking to doctors, and people always think that to everything that people are suffering, there's a cure. There's a drug, there's a medicine, there's a surgery, there's a procedure for everything. If you're sick and if you're suffering, and the fact of the matter is, pain and suffering in the world like this, what the doctors can actually do, and they'll be the first to admit it, like this. Right? Right? And these miracle drugs that they advertise on TV. And said, if you get this drug, then you will feel great. And you see somebody who's going like this and walking through life so sad. And there's a dark cloud over their head. But all of a sudden, they take the medicine and they start walking. And they're all happy. And they look like they could live to 100. This is our society. This is our culture. No wonder suffering is so hard. We also feel that we have a right not to suffer. We have a right not to suffer. So if anybody suffers, what do you do? If you suffered, you need to sue, right? Anybody suffers, then you need to sue because you have a right not to suffer. This is our culture. Because suffering is not the way it should be, it says. Someone needs to be held accountable for this. If you suffered, you need to sue. The point is that in our culture, we think there shouldn't be any suffering. And the end result is because there is suffering in the world, because there is suffering in our lives, every single one of us will have to go through it, through many trials and tribulations and troubles and suffering and pain in our lives. The end result is that our culture, in fact, does not prepare you for suffering at all. In fact, it disequips you for suffering. Therefore, in one sense, to hear what James says about suffering is probably more important for us. It's more important for us to hear what James says about suffering than even the first audience, the first hearers of his letters. Because we have even more trouble with suffering and dealing with suffering than the first hearers did. You're going to face trials. You're going to face suffering. And that's what James tells us. That's the first thing. Now then, how can we deal with the suffering? James gives us, I think, three disciplines in the context of this the passage that we read. And I want to go through them in the rest of the time that we have. And I call them disciplines because what's a discipline? Versus just something that you do? A discipline is something that you do, and you do again, and you do again, and you get better at it, right? And you're not so good at it the first time, but you do it, you do it, you do it constantly. And it's a practice, and you learn to do it better and better. And you actually become good at it eventually. But it's something that requires not just effort, but practice and training. The first thing, James says, is that we need to gain a new perspective. New perspective. It says, consider it pure joy when you face trials of many kinds. Consider it pure joy when you face trials of many kinds. When you, on the first blush, when you hear something like that, you think he's saying, be masochists. You know? You're suffering? Awesome! Yeah. Like some sort of spiritual marines. It's like, oh, I love pain. I feed off of pain. That's not what he is saying. He says, consider it joy. He knows He knows that when you're suffering, the emotion that accompanies suffering, the appropriate emotion that accompanies suffering is not joy, but rather sorrow, sadness, right? If you're suffering and you feel joy, you know, you need to seek counseling for that. But rather, he says, consider it joy. Deliberately, consciously, take a new perspective. Discipline. And what is that perspective? He says, look at the possible results of the suffering. Consider it joy. Why should I do that? Because the testing and the trials can develop your perseverance, your maturity, and completeness so that you would not lack anything. Verse 4, it says, so that it would develop your perseverance, develop your maturity into completeness, so you would be complete, so you would not lack for anything. So he's saying, I want you to consider the fact that suffering, if you handle it right, can turn you into a mature person, complete and not lacking in anything, which means you will be equipped for every task that you may be called upon to serve. When I was younger, I think this would have sounded a little bit hollow, but I know this is true now. And I think if you've gone through suffering, and there's a little bit of a divide here, right? So there's, and it is a little bit based on age, but maybe you have gone lived a very guarded life as well, and you're older as well. But if you know that if you have been through suffering, this is to be true. But if you have never experienced suffering, that you would actually think it's a little bit crazy, but it's absolutely true. I'm saying older the wiser right now. Suffering, listen, this is what James is saying. Suffering equips you to be a better father, a better mother. Suffering equips you to be a better husband, a better wife. Suffering equips you to be a better man, a better woman. It equips you to understand yourself. It equips you to make good decisions in life. It equips you to help. It helps you to know your limitations. In other words, suffering equips you to do everything you do much, much better. James is saying, I want you to realize that perseverance and full maturity can be the actual result of your suffering. Suffering, in one sense, can be the fertilizer for your Christian growth. It doesn't smell good. You want to avoid it when you encounter it. But it is the thing that will make you grow. And you know this to be true if you've suffered at all. Suffering can be the heat, the furnace to purify you, to bring out the gold in you. Again, it doesn't say you should be happy about suffering. There's nothing good about suffering. You remember Jesus asked, even himself during the last night of the cross, he said he asked for the cup of suffering to be passed from him, right? He didn't want to just take on the suffering. He did. But he prayed if it is God's will that he would let this cup pass. Suffering and pain are not part of God's plan. He didn't make Garden of Eden. He didn't make creation with suffering. He hates it. It is God's mission to eradicate it. But he promises that if you do come to me with suffering, I can work this out, that somehow that suffering can be turned into a good. Not that the suffering itself is good, but that the suffering that you experience can be turned in such a way so that the result, the end result, will be good. That's what Romans 8:28 tells us, really. Apostle Paul suffered, and a couple of weeks ago, Pastor Sam talked about, a few months ago actually, right? So Apostle Paul's experience of the thorn on his side, right? Some of you guys remember that from 2 Corinthians. Paul talks about a thorn on his side, and he says he prayed to God, he prayed to the Lord three times that this thorn on the side would be taken away. And we're not exactly sure, once again, what this thorn on the side is. It might be an actual physical thing. It might be a figurative thing. It could be a person, whatever it is. But he says, God, Jesus said, no. No, because that is not going to be the way in which grace is going to enter into your life. My grace is going to be sufficient for you. And this is the thorn on your side that is going to help you receive that grace. And Paul was good with that. Do you know why Paul says he received this thorn on his side? Why he needed it? Because he said he was conceited. The words before that he used. And the word is actually interesting because it's the Greek word, it says, because he had a big head, literally. A swelled head. So that I might not get a big head. Think about Apostle Paul. Some people might consider him the most brilliant man in all of Christianity, right? This is the guy, when you think about theology, Jesus laid down all of the resources, but Paul kind of puts everything together and helps us to understand what the theology is that really forms everything about the Christian faith, right? You can't understand New Testament without Paul, right? I'm not saying who's smarter, Jesus or Paul, okay? But Paul, and Jesus has kind of like a edge. But Paul is the smartest human being, and he puts all of these things together, and he says, I would have gotten a swelled head. God gave me this thorn on the side, this suffering specifically, so that God can actually use me for his good. So that my big head would not get in the way. So that even though the suffering was painful, so that even though this thorn on the side was something that caused a great amount of distress in my life, I prayed. And God said, no, you need this. And I said, and Paul says, this was so that I can really be used by God. And he saw the end result of this. He saw the end result of the suffering. And he says, I am good with that. And I love that. The fact of the matter is, trials come along and you teach yourself. And they teach you through these trials. These trials teach you your limitations, your flaws. They teach you humility and self-knowledge. Trials help us to be empathetic to other people. If you don't suffer, it is hard to understand what other people are going through and they're suffering, right? People always have these kind of moments in which somebody's going through a hard time and you haven't gone through such a similar hard time on your own, and you say something, and then later on you go through the experience of that, a very similar hardship. And then later on you go, oh my goodness, did I really say that to that person when that my friend was going through that? You guys know what I'm talking about? Because afterwards you realize, wow, it is only in my pain, it is only as I go through the suffering myself that I realize what empathy is. I realize and I can understand what this person's pain is now. And I'm able to minister to other people. And trials almost always show us that there are some things that you thought you couldn't live without, but now you can. So in other words, trials make you useful. Our suffering, without suffering, it's really hard to become useful. So that's what James says we need to look forward to. He says, makes you complete, mature, so that you would not be lacking in anything to serve God's kingdom. That's the first discipline. Have perspective. Second thing. Second discipline, James says, is verse 5 says, if then any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. The second discipline is to seek wisdom. In verse 5, it says, ask for wisdom to get you through. Ask for wisdom. Wisdom is the right truth for the right moment, right? Both of those things together. The right truth, the appropriate truth, and the appropriate moment. You can't stock up on it, but you need to ask for it, James says. Wisdom, you can't just memorize wisdom, wise sayings, and you can't just memorize wisdom and then try to just give it out as much as you can. You just kind of have to go through it on your own, and you experience it, and then when you experience the wisdom, then it hits truth. Let me give you a couple of examples. I remember Esther and I were going through a real hard time at the hospital one time, and I was at loss for words. I didn't know how to comfort my wife at that time, didn't know what to say. And this nurse, a seasoned nurse, turned to us and just gave us this word, and she said, "Just get through this day." She said to us, "Just get through this day. Just find, just be strong enough to get through this day." I said, "Will you do that?" And that's all she said. And I still remember that. I still remember when she said it, because both of us absolutely needed that. And it hit us like a truth, and it comforted us, and it got us through that day, got us through the next day, and got us through that week, that trial. Now, go back. You take that out of context. What does that mean, just get through this day? It's kind of like meaningless if you just kind of abstract it and put it out there and just say, you know, my advice to you that everybody should listen to is just get through this day. You just go, what does that mean? How is that helpful? That's not eternal truth. But that's wisdom, the right truth for the right moment. And it's meaningful to you, and it helps you get through that moment. So seek wisdom, James is saying. Another time, there was a point in which we were hitting almost 6 years of infertility. And Esther met up with a wise friend, and she gave her counsel, and she met up with her for lunch, and she came back with a couple of very meaningful things. And one thing was, she came back with a bag of rocks. And I was like, what is that? I said, oh, I can't even begin to explain it to you. She says, like, stones, like little black stones. I'm like, are you going to throw it at me? Are you really mad? Am I going to get hurt? She said, no. And she looked at these rocks very fondly. You know, it's like, because they were meaningful to her. And she also came back with a verse from Habakkuk. Though the fig tree does not bloom, and listen to this, listen to these words, because some of you guys have heard this, but it may comfort you one day, but it will, anyway. Though the fig tree does not bloom, and there are no grapes on the vines, though the olive crop fails, and fields produce no food, though there are no sheep in the pen, and no cattle in the stalls, yet I will praise the Lord. That's what it says. And I treasure that verse along with Esther, and I began to treasure those rocks too. They gave Esther great comfort. That's wisdom to get her through that moment. But again, what does that mean? I mean, those are rocks. If somebody told you, hold on to some rocks and it will help you get through trouble, you go, what? No. Or even Habakkuk, listen to that verse. Even though I have nothing, even though there's no fruit on my trees, even though my refrigerator is empty, although my bank account is completely wasted, and all I get are bills in the mail, yet I will praise the Lord. If you guys say yes, amen to that, you're not thinking here, really, because it makes no sense. But you are feeling it here, right? Because you've gone through situations and you're connecting it with moments in which that truth was powerful for you. But as an eternal truth, to try to build a theology around that, I think that would be hard. That's wisdom. When you're going through a difficult time, I heard someone say it is like free climbing. Some of you guys, I know Young used to rock climb before he went into his favorite sport of cycling. Some of you guys may have watched rock climbing, right? Anybody ever experienced rock climbing for yourself? Anybody ever do it? Just, wow, really? Okay. But free climbing is when you climb these rock faces without any rope, without any harness. I saw this special, a 60-minute special of this guy named Alex Honnold. You saw this guy? Okay. He climbed the Half Dome, Yosemite Half Dome. And he broke the world record and by a lot, by a long shot. He said 2 hours, free climbing, just with his hands and his feet. And by 2 hours and 50 minutes, he climbed up Half Dome. And there was a point in which the reporter they were watching him climb up Half Dome through binoculars, and there was an expert climber. He's an old guy. He's been through all of these things. He doesn't climb himself anymore, but he was explaining what he was doing. And the old guy, the expert commentator said, "Oh, he's really booking now," says this. 2 hours and 50 minutes up Half Dome. You know how fast that is, an average of? 12 feet per minute. 12 feet. I did it like, what, five? 5 seconds. And he's like, "He's really booking now." I was like, "Whoa. What do you mean he's really booking? It's all relative." Well, he was really booking because before that, the free climb, the very first time that somebody free climbed Half Dome, I found out, was 34 hours. They're moving inches. 34 hours. Free climbing, what you do is you got 2 feet, you need to get a toehold, handhold, right? And you need to have 3 of those on the rock at one time, right? That's what you do. And then with the third part, whether it's your hand or a toe or whatever, with your foot, you try to find the next piece. Just one next piece at a time. The next piece, next piece, next piece, one thing at a time. And that's what wisdom is, to help us get over the mountains. You're just looking for that one next thing to help you to just get over the mountains. And it takes time. It's a very slow process, mostly. But somehow, you make it through the other side. And that's the picture of wisdom that James gives us. When you're struggling, God will give you wisdom. You need to seek it. You need to seek wisdom, not in terms of trying to get that one big answer that will get you through everything all at once, that will answer all of your questions and get you through the trials in that next minute. No, not that. But he says, seek wisdom. Find that next truth that will get you through that suffering. Everybody has to find their own way. And what is wise in one situation is not necessarily going to be wise in another. But this is the sort of wisdom that James is talking about. Because without wisdom, you can't hold your breath. You can't just grit your teeth and just wait for the suffering to go by. You go through it, through the process. The third discipline, then, that James talks about. So first is to have perspective. Second is to seek wisdom. And the third discipline is you need to learn why you doubt. It's a little bit harder with verse 6 when it says, when you ask for wisdom, you must believe and not doubt. Because the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. If you want wisdom, it says, you cannot doubt. Now, how many of you guys have ever thought about faith and doubt like this? You think faith is something along the lines of, well, I am going to convince myself, psychologically convince myself, get myself in some sort of a self-hypnosis so that I cannot think I will fail. How many of you guys ever think faith was like that and not doubting was like that? Right? You just, nope. There's no way that, yeah, nope. I'm going to get through it. It'll pass. It'll pass for sure because I'm not even thinking about anything else. And you kind of do this mind game with yourself, right? And this is not what this is talking about. That's not doubt. That's another picture of doubt. Because that's just, you know, that's just, it feels a little bit like some sort of like a science fiction thing in which you just kind of will it. If you really will it hard enough, it will become a reality. And that's not faith. That's not faith. The Greek word for doubt here is interesting. And I'll share with you. And the Greek word is dipsychos. Di meaning two, and psychos meaning mind. Right? Two minds, double-minded, it says later on. It says, someone who doubts is someone who has two minds. Verse 8, don't be double-minded. It says, don't be divided, in other words, in your loyalties. Don't be divided in your thinking. Don't be divided in terms of what you commit yourself to. Don't be double-minded. Meaning, one of the reasons why we're thrown by suffering is that we're divided in our loyalties. We say, I believe in God, I am loyal to him, but you're also loyal to other things. You have a double mind or a triple mind or whatever else. The opposite of that is as to persevere. And again, the term is interesting because, and we'll get to persevere a lot more throughout this text, but persevere literally means to stand firm. Doubt is to be double-minded and to almost stand on a double ground in terms of a foundation. To persevere is to stand firm. Jesus gives a picture of this when he says, don't build your house on sand. Right? Instead, build your house on a rock. Which is Jesus saying, you need to set the foundations of your life on me, the rock, the only thing that is reliable. And the sand is making the foundation of your life on anything other than Jesus, whether it's your family, or the approval of others, whether it's success or acceptance or recognition of others, whether it's status symbols in your life, achieving those statuses in your life, or your job, whatever else it is. But then, Jesus says, then the storms will come. Those who are on the rock will survive, will thrive. The storm will not move them. They will stand firm. But those on sand, the foundation shall be rocked loose, and they will lose their way. Because if you built your entire life on the love of a person and you lose that person, you fall. If you build your entire life on the status of being a very successful person and something happens and your career derails or reverses, you fall. It's simple. You want to withstand the storms of life, build on the rock. Here is the thing, folks. Most Christians, most of us, we don't build our lives completely on the rock. We're double-minded. It's not completely on sand either. It's a little bit like a beach house. We build on the rock, but we also build on the sand. The thing is, though, we're convinced that we built ourselves on the rock until the storms come. Because ordinarily, house on sand, it's fine. On a regular, everyday, ordinary life, it's fine. But when the storms come, when there's a health issue in somebody's life or your life, when there's a major disappointment, a rejection, when there's a reversal of fortunes in your life, something really bad happens, you begin to totter, right? Your whole house is tottering and you're not standing fast. You are divided. You are double-minded. This is the source of your doubt. So what happens in situations like this? Somebody's goes to church, but They have actually, without even themselves acknowledging it, they built their life also on their career. They've also built their life on their sense of success or a business account or their savings account or whatever else. And when that gets derailed, or when something happens in your life where it looks like it's going to go the other way, you panic, right? What you need to know is during this time then, become aware of the source of your doubts. You cannot. Do you see how double-minded it is when you pray to God, God, this situation in my work, Lord, please, please let me get this. Please, please let me get this. When you start praying that, do you see how double-minded that is? Say, oh, please, if I do not get this recognition, my life will be over. Or if I fail at this, oh, I'm going to be so sunk. Or if this person rejects me, I am going to be so completely sunk. Do you understand how double-minded that prayer is? You're saying to God, God, be the foundation of my life. And yet at the same time, if I lose this person, then the foundation will be gone. And you're going, what? Which is it? Which one? So when you find yourself going through suffering, it is not rather to beat yourself up. That's the most important thing. But rather to say, look, I am feeling incredibly anxious. I realize I'm not dealing with in a way that is my foundation and is the sole foundation of my life. We need to all acknowledge this and realize this and become aware of our doubts and say that for whatever reason, God, forgive me. I have built my life on that too. Would you help me now? Give me the power and the strength to lean on you even more so. Would you help me now to make my life be upon yours and yours alone? And that is the process of growing through our suffering. Suffering in itself, suffering in itself is not a good thing. Suffering, you can go through suffering and come out on the other side pure as gold, complete, mature, not lacking in anything. Or you could go through suffering, become bitter, even more self-absorbed, and even more unable to have powerful, loving relationships with others because you come together, you turn inward, right? So how are you going to face your sufferings? How are you going to do that? You need to gain perspective. You need to gain wisdom. And you need to learn the source of your doubts when you go through suffering. That's what James is talking about. But I don't want this message, and I just want to close this really quickly now. The last thing that we read in James, James 12, because this is not just a how-to message on how to survive suffering. Ultimately, the thing that you need to get through suffering is not just disciplines. You need to know that you're not alone in your suffering. You need to know that you're not going to go through your sufferings alone. James 12 is a little bit of a summary. Chapter 1, verse 12 is a summary that Apostle James puts on the whole section. It says, blessed is the one, he reminds us. Blessed are you when you persevere under trials, because having stood the test, that person will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised to those who love him. Right? And we kind of take that and say, okay, it's a blessing to be a suffering. But James is saying a whole lot more than that, because if you look at this verse, James says we can persevere because it is a blessing, but because we're also walking in a path that somebody else has walked before and still walks with us. Because if you look at that verse, it's an image of someone who has persevered, who went through a tremendous trial. Blessed is the one who perseveres on the trial. Because having stood the test, as somebody who has now withstood the test, stood up to the test, and has conquered even death to gain the crown of life. So James chapter 1, verse 12, that blessing is a blessing because the first description of that chapter, verse 12, is not of us. Who is it of? It's of Jesus. The first description of the one who has suffered and gained everything because of his ability and the way in which he suffered is Jesus. And James is reminding us that we now walk in that path. And not only that, we are able to walk with him. We walk with him. We do not suffer alone. We go through the suffering, but we can go knowing that the path of suffering that we go through now is a path that Jesus knows because Jesus has walked it. Some time ago, I gave you an illustration of me being able to finish a run because somebody else ran it with me. Young and I are preparing for a big ride, a ride that we haven't finished this sort of a distance before, this sort of hardship. It's 120 miles. Next Saturday we're going to do this. And guess what? I have never done 120 miles. In my practices, I rode 80 miles this week, and I thought, man, I was suffering so much. But here's what I know about bicycle riding. I know if I'm riding with someone, I could actually quantify how much more I can ride because I'm going to ride with someone, even if it's young. I know 20% easily. I could ride another 20%. I add on 20%. It's still not quite 120 miles, but I know I can do it because I can do it with somebody else. The thing that James is pointing out to us is this. What is your percentage? What number would you put to how much better you can endure hardship and suffering in your life? Because you know that Christ himself walks with you. That Christ is with you in your walk. Christ is with you as you suffer. What sort of number would you put to that? Let's pray. As you think about this powerful truth that Christ himself walks with you, empowers you through your hardship and trials. And as Pastor Sam comes up and leads us in a time of communion, which is a powerful reminder of Christ's presence with us, may we keep this truth and may we keep this wisdom in our lives.